Well, I want to thank the organizers very much for the opportunity and pleasure to come and chat with you a little bit today. And so there's a little change in the title. I'll talk about multiscale modeling of biomimetic systems, designing synthetic leukocytes and artificial cilia. And the people who actually did this work were members of my group, Pratyush Dayal, Amitabh Bhattacharya, Olga Kuksnok, and German Kolmakoff. I'm going to take a slightly different tack. I've very much enjoyed all these extremely beautiful, elegant talks about methodology. I'm going to talk very little bit about the methodology, but I'll be happy to answer questions during the question-answer period, and mostly tell you about results of using these different methods. So the challenges that we were confronted with were looking at systems that have soft, squishy bits that are on the micron to millimeter length scale. They interact with nanoparticles, or they interact with submicron species in solution, and there's a surrounding fluid. So we have to model the soft, squishy bits, the nanoparticles, and the fluid, and the dynamics in particular, and the dynamic interactions amongst all of them. And those are the challenges. And I think one of the other challenges that we're very interested in is how do you communicate these results to experimentalists such that you give them clear guidelines, so that you give them a recipe for, here are my predictions, how might you be able to carry out experiments that validate these predictions? And we've had a lot of fun doing that, so I'll tell you about some nice experimental results as well. So the first example I'll tell you about, I'm really, really excited about this, is we tried to design a synthetic leukocyte. So I spent an enormous amount of time Googling stuff. I think I spent half my day looking at images of these things, of things in particular. And I came across this image of how leukocytes behave, and I just totally fell in love with it. I was just very, very excited. And so the way leukocytes behave, you know, on a level where I understand no biology, is that they're recruited to local inflammation, to local damage. They roll along the surface, and they pinpoint themselves to the region of damage, and then they initiate some kind of wound repair. And so the question I was really interested in, can we design a synthetic system that could achieve some kind of repair on a synthetic surface? And so Todd Emmerich actually drew this lovely cartoon. What we're going to do is consider a microcapsule that contains nanoparticles. It's going to roll on a surface. When it comes to a defect, can we trigger it to release the nanoparticles, deposit the nanoparticles, heal the damage, and then move on so that it could do future repair as well. So in that sense, act like a synthetic leukocyte. And we are going to constrain ourselves to consider no biological components. In my toolbox, I don't have any biological components, which is an incredible challenge because biology has this lovely machinery to accomplish all these difficult tasks. But I'm going to remove that from my toolbox. So I only have synthetic units to work with. And for our synthetic leukocyte, we're going to consider things that are our microcapsules. In particular, we're going to match our simulation parameters to microcapsules made by layer deposition. So you take a solid sphere and you deposit positively charged species, and then on top a negatively charged species, and build up a lovely microcapsule, and then you can wash out the interior layer. The reason for focusing on microcapsules is they're about the same size as cells, and you can encapsulate things on the inside, which then can communicate with the outside world, so that's really important to my story. And you can functionalize the surface so it can also communicate with those substrates. So it's a lovely little carrier for the task that I'd like to accomplish. Now, how do I model this? Again, I'm going to gloss over a little bit the modeling, but I'll be happy to answer questions about that during the question and answer period. So for my shell, so here's my little microcapsule. It's a soft compliant shell, and it's going to interact with the substrate. I'm going to have water surrounding it and water on the inside, and then this thing is going to release nanoparticles to the solution. So the fluid on the outside, the fluid on the inside, I'm going to use the lattice Boltzmann model. The particles just do Brownian dynamics, and the substrate and the shell of the capsule are something we call, other people call as well, the lattice spring model. So for the purposes of this talk, but again, I'll be happy to answer questions afterwards, lattice Boltzmann model is just an efficient solver for the Navier-Stokes equation. I think someone else brought up the word lattice Boltzmann, Professor Doi mentioned lattice Boltzmann, and again, I'll be happy to answer questions about it. But if you just assume it's an efficient solver for the Navier-Stokes equation for the time being, then that would be perfect. All right, and then the capsule, the round capsule on the substrate, are made from something called lattice spring model, which is just as the name implies, it's just a network of hooking springs. You can make a neo hooking if you want. And at every node, you solve F equals MA. So you can have a compliant material. The challenge here, and this was beautifully solved by one of my postdocs, Alexander Alexeev, and Rolf Verberg, and Gavin Buxton before him, is to capture the fluid structure interaction problem so that the viscous forces from the fluid hit the compliant capsule and the compliant capsule hits back on the fluid. So there's momentum transfer right at that interface. And the details of that are given in this paper. And then, as I said, I'll touch back on the motion of the Brownian particles. So for my leukocyte system, I'm going to specify the nature of the capsule and the nature of the fluid and the nature of the particles on the inside. So my capsule is going to be hydrophilic on the outside, so it can be soluble in a water phase. It's going to encapsulate oil. It's going to be hydrophobic on the inside, and the particles are going to be functionalized with hydrophobic ligands so they can be solubilized in the oil phase. I'm going to have a hydrophilic surface, but the crack in my surface is going to be hydrophobic. And you'll see why I needed these different components in order to construct the system. There'll be an imposed flow that pushes the capsule along the surface. The capsule interacts with the surface through a simple Morse potential, and I think that's all I wanted to say about that. I think I've covered everything on that slide. The motion of the nanoparticles is just given here. It's just Brownian dynamics, but when there is fluid flow, they're also advected by the fluid, so they move with the velocity of the fluid. All right, so remember I said the surface of my capsule is hydrophilic. There's water, there's fluid, a hydrophilic fluid, lattice Boltzmann fluid, and there's an imposed flow pushing it along the hydrophilic surface. The crack is hydrophobic. When the capsule becomes localized in the crack, and you'll see that in a minute, then there's a finite probability that the hydrophobic particles adsorb onto the hydrophobic surface. This is purely just an enthalpic effect. All right, so when I put the simulation together, here's what it looks like. I'll show you three different cases, low shear, moderate shear, and high shear. And so at low shear, here's my little happy fellow, and it moves along, that is an imposed shear, and it gets into the crack, and it's sort of like a hen. It's depositing these little purple nanoparticle eggs, yeah? And then, but at low shear, there isn't enough oomph to get it out of the crack, okay? And so then, okay, this one is moderate shear. So here comes the little hen. It deposits, it deposits some of its nanoparticle eggs into the crack, and it moves away, which is ideally what I'd like. I'd like what a system that we've now called repair and go. So it deposits nanoparticles in the crack and moves away. But it didn't stay there for too long, so that's a bit problematic. And now, finally, at high shear, you know, you can sing along, I'll fly away. So high shear clearly is a bad scenario for my case, where I want to fill the crack with nanoparticles. But what I can do is actually pinpoint a region in phase space where the capsules get arrested in the crack and where they keep moving. And I can plot that as a function of this dimensionless adhesion parameter, which has, this is a parameter for the Morse potential, This is the number of nodes on the capsule that interact with the surface. This is the Young's modulus. This is the radius of the capsule, and this is the cutoff for the range of the potential. And I can plot then as a function of the imposed shear rate versus this dimensionless adhesive interaction when the capsule gets arrested in the crack and when it keeps moving. Clearly, at high adhesive interactions, it'll get arrested in the crack, and at high shear rates, it'll keep moving. Remember, the whole point was that I want the capsule to go into the crack and deposit a lot of the nanoparticles. Well, it will certainly do that when it's arrested, but I also want it to keep moving and be available for healing other sites. So if it becomes arrested, it does certainly deposit a lot of nanoparticles, but it can't do repair and go. And if it keeps moving, if I'm at high shear, then it can't deposit a lot of nanoparticles, but it'll move on. So how can I create a scenario where I can get it to come and rest in the crack and lay these purple, lovely little purple eggs, but then yet move on? And that's when we came upon this idea of having a pulsed flow. So, and you kind of know where, what shear rates you should apply, because we had this nice little phase diagram as a function of the shear rate and the attraction. So at early times, or a particular time of the cycle, I can apply one shear rate and then suddenly increase the shear rate so that I get a high deposition and it leaves the crack. Right? So I can, the ideal then situation we thought is this pulse shear rate. So I must tell you that we started this work in 2007. And from 2007, we've been talking with Todd Emmerich and Tom Russell and Al Crosby. So the results I'll show you, which I think are the experimental results, which I think are really quite lovely, you have to realize that they have taken a long time. This has been a long evolution. But they did a really lovely job. And to make the capsules, they said, all right, now again, this is why one needs very specific instructions. They said, fine, we can make a capsule that's hydrophilic on the outside and hydrophobic on the inside if I use a comb copolymer. So the comb copolymer has hydrophilic teeth and a hydrophobic backbone. Here are the nanoparticles, they're quantum dots, and they're coated with hydrophobic ligands. And what Todd did very beautifully, he threw everything into a solution, into an oil-water solution. And so these localize in an oil-water interface. They encapsulate the oil, and they encapsulate the quantum dots. And I want to emphasize how lovely this experiment was, because they can form this object all in one step. So we have the capsule. And then it was Al Crosby who came up with this lovely idea, which is that you take PDMS, which is a hydrophobic material, and then you do a UVO treatment. So you essentially deposit a layer of hydrophilic glass on top of the hydrophobic surface. Then you take it, and you can either swell, you can do it two ways. You can swell this in a solvent for the PDMS, and that causes the glass layer to crack. Or you can just stretch it, and it causes the glass layer to crack. You have a hydrophilic surface, but the cracks, you've exposed hydrophobic material underneath. So you have a hydrophilic surface with hydrophobic cracks. So that was really lovely. So now we have all the components, and yes, the trick works. So, and they were also very kind to accommodate us by, here's their apparatus, and with that apparatus, they can have a pump that they can do this pulsed shear flow, so that there's a period where the capsules can rest in the crack, and the capsules can move on. And you can get a hint from this picture that the trick works very beautifully. So, in fact, let me go back. Remember, I said there were quantum dots, so that they fluoresce. So you can see exactly where the nanoparticles are. And here are the cracks, and the particles fluoresce in green, so you can see that the nanoparticles are localized in the cracks. And you can see this very nicely here as well. Here are the cracks, and here in the nanoparticles localized in the cracks. And this is what the particle-laden microcapsules looked like before the experiments, and here's what they looked like after the experiments. So they've depleted, they're devoid of the nanoparticles because the nanoparticles are now localized in the cracks. So clearly you want to do some controlled experiments to see if the mechanism is that the capsules are rolling over the surface, depositing nanoparticles, and moving on. And so they did some very, very beautiful controlled experiments. That is, let's just take some capsules without the nanoparticles and do the experiment. And you can also label the capsules so that they also can be recognized, that they also fluoresce. And if there are no hydrophobic nanoparticles in the capsules, then the capsules are just localized all over the surface. They don't localize in the crack. Right? Now let's take the other extreme limit. We remove the capsules and just have nanoparticles, and you can do this experiment in water and have PEG on the surface of the nanoparticles, and they'll just go everywhere. Right? And then finally, you can take this beautiful surface with the crack in it and then do the UVO experiment again, so that you take the hydrophobic regions and make them hydrophilic. So everywhere now is hydrophilic, even the cracks. And so there's no enthalpic difference between the top surface of the crack. And now there are no nanoparticles anywhere to be seen. They just remain inside the capsule. So I think they've very nicely shown this, that the nanoparticles that are localized inside the capsule that are hydrophobic are necessary. Those capsules necessary as the delivery system. The nanoparticles being hydrophobic are necessary. And the nanoparticles that are hydrophobic go into the hydrophobic crack. So that's the first story where involved this multi-scale scenario where we had the soft, squishy capsules, the nanoparticles, and the fluid. So let me tell you another story, which we use a different modeling technique that also involves soft, squishy things, sub-micron species, and a fluid. And that's having to do with designing artificial cilia. So cilia, you know, are these little hairy things, and they line a lot of your cells in your body, in your trachea. They serve to expel particles, and they do all sorts of other functions. You know, Michael Rubenstein has done these beautiful studies and is very interested in the role of cilia in terms of, where's Michael there, transporting mucus in cystic fibrosis. So cilia play an incredibly important role in your body. I just mentioned this article because this article was just stunning to me. Cilia can sense bitter. So when you taste something bitter, then the cilia start beating very quickly to try to expel that object from your mouth. So they have incredible chemoresponsive sensibilities. And so we were interested in trying to design synthetic cilia that move in a concerted way and might have chemoresponsive behavior. And so you have to pick the right material. Just before we picked microcapsules to be our carriers, if we want to design these synthetic cilia with chemoresponsive abilities and this lovely oscillating motion, the material we're going to pick now are gels called the BZ gels. So these are gels that are undergoing the Balazov-Zabotinsky reaction. So the Balazov-Zabotinsky reaction was literally one of the first, if not the first, autocatalytic reactions that was discovered. It was sort of the cornerstone of nonlinear chemical dynamics. And it was discovered by accident in the late 50s, but in the late 90s, Ryo Yoshida, who we collaborate with, said, let me put this Balazov-Zabotinsky reaction in a chemical gel. And what the gel does, I keep hitting it. Come on, little guy. What the gel does, it undergoes these autonomous oscillations. So this lovely piece of gel is sitting in a petri dish. There's no external stimuli causing this to oscillate. Okay? So it's really the only example of an autonomously oscillating material. Millimeter-sized pieces in a petri dish will oscillate for hours without your having to do anything. And the reason this works is you anchor a ruthenium catalyst onto the backbone of the polymer gel. This is undergoing the Bzeri reaction. You put the Bzeri agents as well into the petri dish, and it does its redox reaction. So in the oxidized, when it's in the oxidized phase, it's a more hydrating environment for the gel, so the gel swells. When this is in the reduced phase, it's a less hydrating environment for the gel, so the gel collapses. So it just does this beautiful motion autonomously. And this is sort of a small piece where the chemomechanical behavior is completely coordinated. If you look at a larger piece, because I pushed the wrong button. If you look at a larger piece, then you'll see these beautiful waves developing that look a lot like the kinds of waves that you get for a Bzeri reaction in solution. I'm sorry, maybe I should hit it again. There it is. So here you see these beautiful spatiotemporal waves. And this is just the only difference between this piece and this piece is size. So if you make it larger, then you'll see the spatiotemporal waves that look like the Bzeri reaction in solution. Okay, so we actually developed the first computational model where you could look at shape changes in a chemoresponsive gel. There had been models before where the gel was assumed to be one-dimensional, which you could then capture volume changes, but you can't capture shape changes, so you need to go to two or three dimensions. And we were greatly aided in the context of the Bzeri reaction because there was a very beautiful model called the Organator model, and it was called the Organator model because it was developed in Oregon. And so what the Organator model did was it said, look, this Bzeri reaction is extremely complicated, but I can model it in terms of two parameters. One is U, which I'll keep mentioning U again. U is the activator for the reaction. As opposed to the inhibitor, it's the activator for the reaction. And then V, which is the volume fraction of the oxidized catalyst. Right? So this very complicated reaction, the Organator model says I can capture in just in those two critical parameters. And there's very beautiful correspondence between the Organator model for the Bzeri reaction in solution and the actual experiments. So we just adapted the Organator model, but my system is a gel. So then I have to write down an evolution equation for the gel. This is the evolution equation for the volume fraction of oxidized catalyst. This is the evolution equation for you. I borrowed these from the Organator model, but I had to include in these equations the presence of polymer, and Victor Yassin did that in my group. And again, I had to have the evolution equation for the polymer. So F, oh dear, okay, F and G I take from the Organator model, and they characterize the kinetics of the reaction, and modify that to include the volume fraction of polymer present. Again, G is a variable that characterizes the kinetics of the reaction. The system obeys relaxational dynamics, so the force is proportional to the velocity. It's an incompressible system, so I can write down where phi is the volume fraction of polymer and the velocity of the polymer, 1 minus phi is the amount of solvent. Members of my group developed this very lovely model called the gel lattice spring model to solve those equations numerically on a lattice. Remember I said it was relaxational dynamics, so the force is proportional to the velocity, so I know the potential because I use the Fourier model for elasticity and the Fourier-Huggins expression for the polymer-solvent interaction for the gel. So having the potential, I can get the force, then from the force I can get the velocity and I can numerically solve those equations. There's only one adjustable parameter, all the other parameters we try to take from experiments, and that's this parameter chi star, which is a measure of the coupling of the chemical reaction to the response, the strength of the response of the gel. All right, so that's our gel lattice spring model. We tried to validate that with experiments. We can do that qualitatively, though we're doing more and more with Ryo Yoshida to do more quantitative comparisons. And qualitatively, similar to experiments, if this piece is small enough, and I should have mentioned, I will go back to it at the end, that that little piece, the triangular piece that I showed you, was made by Irene Chen and Kristen Van Vliet at MIT, and we collaborate with them as well, and I'll show you some more results from their lab in a minute. So qualitatively, we also capture in the simulation so that if the piece is small, that the chemomechanical oscillations are completely coupled. We see under certain circumstances, if a piece is tethered, then the oscillations will start from the bottom to the top, though I want to spend more time on that. If we increase the concentration of malonic acid, then the period of the oscillations decreases. So we can capture those experimental observations. And then we had a nice collaboration with Professor Yoshida, where he takes a piece that is bent, because there's a gradient in cross-link density, and here are the experiments, and here are the simulations. And if you look very carefully, this moves autonomously upwards, and this one does as well, too, but you have to wait a long time for the experimental piece to move upwards. I'm sorry I've been speaking a little slowly, and I only have 5 minutes. So what we want to do now is we want to anchor those BZ gels to a substrate to make the cilia, and the unit of length is 25 microns, so these can be millimeter-sized pieces. That's one unit of length, and the unit of time is about 0.3 seconds. All right, we have no flux boundary conditions on the bottom, and we impose U equals zero on the sides of the box, where U is the activator. But what I do is I vary the amount of U at the top of the box. So U is zero, the activator for the reaction, at the top of the box, and I vary the amount. And what I want to show you here is just by varying the amount of U at the top of the box, I can control the directionality of the wave propagation. And the reason this works is because U, the activator of the reaction, when the little unit is closest to the highest concentration of U, it has a higher frequency. So the frequency of the gel is dependent on the amount of U that it's surrounded by in the solution. The higher the amount of U, the higher the frequency. It therefore acts as a pacemaker, and it directs the propagation of the wave. All right? So here, since U is zero at the top, then U is highest here, so the wave propagates from here. Here, U is comparable, the top and bottom, so the waves originate from both the top and bottom. And here, U is highest at the top, so the wave originates from the top. So I can control the directionality of wave propagation. And furthermore, the distribution of U in the entire system affects the mode of propagation, affects the synchronization. Here, when the cilia are relatively far apart, then the concentration of U is high in between, so the waves actually originate from the center. When they're close together, then U is highest at the top, and the waves propagate from bottom, from top to bottom. How much more minutes do I have?
One.
All right. Okay. So here is five of them. And so they show this beautiful concerted motion like the synthetic cilia. But you can control that by light. The light suppresses the oscillations in the BZ reaction. So I can introduce a parameter in my model. And when light of a particular intensity and wavelength is shined on these gels, it suppresses the oscillations. So in an isolated sample, here's in the absence of light, here's in the presence of light, the oscillations are suppressed. But if I have a bunch of them, and I shine light on the first three, then I can modulate the pattern. But U, which is being produced by the ones where I don't shine light, diffuses to these guys, and they sense the U, and therefore they'll still oscillate. So the take-home message I'd like you to have is that these cilia communicate through U, where they're chemo-responsive, chemo-sensitive, they communicate through U, and you can manipulate that communication through light And therefore, you can manipulate the pattern of oscillations in this cilia. And so we say you can play the cilia like a keyboard. And here's the top of the cilia. And you can see they sort of move like a keyboard. So for the last slide, I'll just show you some really recent results. These are actually on New Scientist. And these are from Kristen Van Vliet and Irene Chen's experiment group. So Irene had this lovely idea. I'm not going to use light now, but I'm going to use pressure. And we had done these predictions that you can take something that's in the non-oscillatory phase into the oscillatory phase with pressure. So you have to look very carefully at the smiley face. So she has a smiley face, and all the gels are in the non-oscillatory phase, and she pushes with a glass slide on the mouth. Because she pushes on the glass slide with the mouth, it emits U, and it causes the eyeballs to oscillate, and the eyeballs wink, right? So here's the mouth being pressed on, and now you see little eyeballs winking. But now, if the eyeballs are too far away, then even though she pushes on the mouth and the mouth oscillates, because the eyeballs are too far away, then they don't sense you, and therefore they don't wink at you. So I thought that was a nice slide to end on. So I thank you very much for your attention. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Gorgeous simulations.
Thank you.
I have a technical question and another question about the first part. And the technical question is, how did you couple the volume of oil and particles inside the your particle? You have tiny particles, hydrophobic particles, and oil inside.
Oh, for the capsules.
For the capsules.
Yeah.
How does the volume of oil couples to the oscillations, elastic oscillations of the capsule?
Before I answer that, I should have mentioned to you that the particles are tracer particles, so they just diffuse freely in the
oil. So the particles themselves don't have any volume?
The particles themselves don't have any volume.
Okay, and the oil does?
And the oil does.
So the oil inside your capsules was conserved volume or not?
Yes, it's conserved volume.
So
right?
Did you have a global constraint on volume? Because you have a...
Yes, that's right. Because there's no diffusion of oil out. There's no inner diffusion.
Right, I understand.
So there's a constrained volume.
So you did run a simulation with a constraint.
Yes, yes.
And then
which is what we really should do, except for oil, it doesn't make any difference because they would stay inside. But what we should really do next is have a nice free diffusion of fluid in and out of the capsule. But the volume of the capsule is constrained.
Okay. And then the physical question is your expulsion of hydrophobic particles from inside the capsule to the outside.
Yes.
When it got absorbed on the hydrophobic substrate.
Yes.
It assumes some kind of a long range because your expulsion rate, there's all it depends on the distance.
Yeah, it does.
What was the physical range of hydrophobic interactions? I'm a little bit concerned about the length scales. Because in experiment, it looked like they had this hair, and so even when particle absorbed, they were kind of far away to get any kind of talking between hydrophobic domain inside the capsule and the substrate. So
I think your point is well taken. There is the maths for the simulation. For the experiment, I think that the hairs get squashed. They might get moved away. I mean, it's a good point. Because I
would expect to have traces. If your mechanism is correct, I would expect to see traces as the particle rolls along. I would see some spots on.
No, because the nanoparticles are hydrophobic. The surface is hydrophilic.
Right.
They don't want to leave.
No. I mean, in the grooves. And the particle passes through the groove. There should be a spot where the particle passed, and it will be deposited, and there will be a nearby spot where particle didn't pass, and it would be blank. And I saw it pretty uniformly layering all along,
yeah.
Which gives me an idea that it basically have some partitioning of your hydrophobic particles between inside and outside, and basically gets transferred, deposited through the bulk, not through the...
Through
collisions.
Yeah, no, I don't know about the experiments. But
did you do a control without flow?
No. You know, I'll have to check. That's a really beautiful question. I'll have to check. Now, the other reason why it might not have looked spotty to you is, remember, the resolution may not be fine enough for you to see that there's some spots, the spottiness that you're looking for, right? Because here the resolution on the experiments is, here's the, you know, the amplification, so. And oh, certainly, and they can move along too. So we also, not all the nanoparticles are going to hit, like, thank you very much. Not all the nanoparticles are going to hit that way. You know, we also have done simulations where they hit off angle, and then they actually roll along in the grooves and deposit that way as well, right? Because they're not all going to hit at 90-degree angles. So then, thank you for bringing that up.
Just a quick follow-up question to that. So there's no evidence from the experiments that the oil also leaks out with the nanoparticles into these hydrophobic cavities?
I think that they're probably, I think that some of the oil does leak out, but they did collect the capsules afterwards, and they could wash them off, and the capsules were still intact.
Okay. So in your simulations, where are you in parameter space in terms of things like a Reynolds number or a capillary number? Looks like there's a lot of inertia in these simulations, which I would not expect for nanoparticles, except at a really high strain rate.
Right. So all of those numbers, I'll refer you to that paper. I'm sorry. We actually did give the capillary number, and we do give the Reynolds number and the capillary number. I can't remember the Reynolds number. But remember, we're solving the complete Navier-Stokes equation. So it's not just in the Stokes limit. There is a finite Reynolds number, so there will be some inertial effects, right? And I can't remember the Reynolds number, but it was less than one, right? And I can't remember the capillary number, but it was something like 10 to the minus third to 10 to the minus fifth, actually. Okay.
So, I mean, I had sort of a similar response. It looked very like a bouncy ball. and it moves down into the crack. Is the range of interaction large compared to the size of the crack? Is that why it falls into the crack in the simulations? Or?
I can't remember the range of the interaction, but the range of the interaction is just a typical Morse potential range of the interaction. I don't think it's very long range.
So it'd be short compared to the crack.
Yeah,
so
I mean, it's certainly short compared to the
ball. Sort of falls down almost like there's a gravitational pull.
Well, there's an imposed pressure. You know, there's an imposed shear flow. No, there's no gravity. There's no gravity, but there is a shear flow, right? And it's soft. And so when it gets, you know, when it feels the edge, you know, it's like your little bum. You're sitting in it. It's very happy to spread out, right?
Why is the capsule not spherical apart from the bump, the crack, and the gravity?
What? Sorry, who? There's an adhesive. Yeah, it's an adhesive. Remember, it's adhesive force. It's a Morse. Yeah, it's an adhesive surface.
On the oscillating gels. So it looks like you've kind of coupled a diffusion reaction model to a two fluid like model.
It's totally that's right. It's a two fluid model for the gel.
But I was confused at the bottom of that the page of the model. You had the kind of volume average velocity zero instead of the being divergence free in an incompressible system.
There are two constraints. It's divergence free because it's an incompressible system, and we assume no net motion. The only motion in our system is the interdiffusion of the solvent and the gel. So there are two constraints. Okay.
So there's really an overall constraint on the total volume average velocity to be zero.
So the system's incompressible,
yeah.
And the only velocities you have in the system are the interdiffusion of polymer and gel. There's no high dynamics in the second story. Right? The first story there is, second story there isn't. The reason why there's no high dynamics in the second story is these gels oscillate so slowly. Movies are a little bit of a speed up. their period, the period of oscillation, is seconds to a minute. And so the gel swells something like microns per second. So hydrodynamics is so not important here.
Well, I understand the divergence-free incompressibility constraint, but I don't see why you would need another constraint that the overall volume average velocity is here.
Because there are these other nice stories where when the, let's say you have solvent being pushed this way, in the chemomechanical waves that travel down this little gel, when the solvent's being pushed that way, then the polymer moves in the opposite direction. And that's sort of what that little rule captures.
Well, it forces that. It's just that I'm wondering whether that's really physical or not.
I don't know what else to do other than have introduce hydrodynamics. So if I want to say that the only fluid dynamics I have is interdiffusion, then I have that constraint.
Question back.
Any other questions? Okay. Before we adjourn, I'd like to thank the three organizers, Mark, Kurt, and Paul, for the meeting this week and for the entire program. And let's just thank them. Mark.
Well, I guess it would be nice if Jocelyn was here. I just want to thank Jocelyn on behalf of us as organizers. She and the rest of the staff here at KITP make it easy to organize these events. And Jocelyn in particular has been very helpful with the conference, and I just want to thank her on behalf of all of us for her good work. All of you for coming. And do you have any announcements you want to make beforehand?
Thank you.
Okay. Well, with that, I guess I declare us adjourned. Let's eat.